Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we celebrate Labor Day, and in recognition of that annual event, on today's show we'll be talking with labor historian Jacqueline Jones. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. Occurring this week in 1935, Louisiana Senator Huey P. Long, more popularly known as the Kingfish, was fatally shot in the state capitol building. Born in 1893 to two moderately prosperous farmers, Long, one of 10 children, studied law at the University of Oklahoma but quit without receiving a degree. He nevertheless passed the Louisiana bar exam, began practicing law in 1915, and soon entered politics. After gaining a statewide reputation for being a hard-nosed, populist lawmaker, Long ran successfully for governor in 1928. He built an extensive network of friends in elected positions throughout the state, and in 1932 was elected to the U.S. Senate. As a newcomer to Washington, Senator Long despised the elitist conservative views of then-President Herbert Hoover, blaming the Great Depression on his lack of national leadership. After supporting Democrat Franklin Roosevelt in his presidential bid, however, Long soon found that much of what he hated in politics, namely big government, could be found in Roosevelt's New Deal. While shoring up the state's support for his own presidential bid in 1936, Long was shot by the son of a political opponent, Carl Austin Weiss, a wealthy New Orleans physician. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the Colorado Senate recently reversed a previous ruling regarding the public portrayal of the site of an Indian massacre. A year ago, legislators approved a measure to remove references to the Sand Creek Massacre from a Civil War statue on state grounds. However, ancestors of the survivors now argue that this would result in the state rewriting history instead of accurately explaining it to the public. At dawn on November 29, 1864, Colonel John Shivington and the 3rd Colorado Volunteer Cavalry attacked the camp at Sand Creek, killing 500 Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians. Most of the unsuspecting victims were women and children. According to one Colorado lawmaker, descendants want the public to know why Sand Creek is something that should always be remembered. In festivities in Berlin, Germany, celebrating the great German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, recently had a damper put on them when it was discovered that 30 years ago, East German scientists exhumed and tampered with Goethe's remains. While many countrymen see this clandestine autopsy as a desecration of a national hero, the Goethe archives maintain it was done in an effort to preserve his delicate remains. While the poet's remains were too fragile for mummification, his flesh was cremated and his skeleton was packed in foam. In the scientist's defense, the coffin was discovered to have been opened once before, refuting the claim that the scientist had disturbed the poet's remains for the first time. You're listening to Talking History.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get?
We're a nation built on the labor of our citizens. Nevertheless, laborers, black and white, have had to struggle for their just desserts, fair wages, and safe working conditions. For this, our special Labor Day show, Talking History's Dennis Mihalik takes a look at the history of American labor with labor historian Jacqueline Jones.
Thank you, Brian. Labor Day is a holiday established to celebrate the contribution made by American working people. Here to put the complex concept of toiling for wages in historical perspective is Jacqueline Jones, professor and chair of the History Department at Brandeis University. Dr. Jones is the award-winning author of several books, including her latest, American Work, Four Centuries of Black and White Labor, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Welcome, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In American Work, you stated that jobs are never just jobs. What do you mean by that phrase?
I mean that jobs are actually social signifiers or social markers. In other words, they tell us where we are in American society. They transcend the work itself. By that I mean the jobs consist not just of the physical or mental tasks that we do, but also they consist of our whole notion, our whole notion of justice, of place in society. And I should add here, too, that the issue is not just what we do at work. It's also the conditions and terms under which we work. So in the 19th century, for example, a carpenter who worked for wages to support his family had a very different kind of work experience compared to an enslaved worker who was also a carpenter, but of course could not labor on his own behalf or on behalf of his family members. So there are several complex levels to work, not only the task itself and the conditions under which it is performed, but also the terms of the labor and where that places us in society in the past or today.
I see. So then you divided the book American Work into three large periods, the first of which you subtitled Insubordinates. What era is that, and what were the prime characteristics of working during that era?
The first section actually deals with the earliest period in American history, primarily the 17th century and on into the 18th century, when a variety of bound workers, including indentured servants from Europe, as well as enslaved Africans, all toiled under the direction of mistresses and masters in the New World. And I found in my study that all of these bound workers had certain things in common. They were regarded as resistant to discipline, recalcitrant, promiscuous. We can include here Indian servants, Indian hirelings in this category. And the white settlers, the colonists themselves, really didn't make distinctions among these groups. As I said, they considered all of these workers to be very difficult to control. And it wasn't until later, in the 18th century actually, that African Americans were considered a very distinct group. But for this beginning period, workers themselves were considered kind of dangerous. They were not always trustworthy, and masters and mistresses were very wary, very suspicious of these workers who at times, of course, cohabited with them.
Mm-hmm. Then the second section is labeled Workers and Overworkers. What's the era and what are the basic characteristics there?
There I was looking at the period of emancipation in the North, 1790 and later, and I was also looking at the period of slavery in the South on into the antebellum period. And my point there, though, was that enslaved workers obviously had to respond to the demands of their masters and mistresses, but at the same time, they worked on their own behalf as well. So, again, we have to see the various layers of work here and understand that even enslaved workers were responding to the needs of their families, the needs of their communities. They were at times engaging in productive labor that did not directly serve the interests of their masters. And I wanted to make the point here that, again, we can't see these issues necessarily in black, white, slave, and free, but we have to understand the control that enslaved workers try to retain over their own productive energies at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then your final segment, part three, is labeled The Rise and Decline of the Racialized Machine.
Yes, there I explored the antebellum period in the North as well as the postbellum period in the South and found that, surprisingly enough, black people were kept out of machine work pretty consistently in both areas of the country. What is ironic here, in a way, I think, is that as enslaved workers, blacks in the South did work machines. Before the Civil War, they were put to work in the textile industry. And yet, after emancipation, those textile operative jobs were restricted to whites. And the same process occurred in the North to some extent, and I found the point here seemed to be to deprive black people in general of what we would consider modern jobs, those jobs working with machinery, and in the process relegate them to traditional pre-industrial kinds of work, agriculture, domestic service, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you stated in terms of this racial competition for work, that each generation of whites redefined themselves in relation to black workers. How and why was that done?
I can give a couple of examples. In the antebellum period in the North, for example, we see a large number of Irish immigrants coming into the country. They are competing for jobs at the lowest echelons of the workforce. White workers, native-born workers, are experiencing radical transformations in the workplace with the rise of industrialization. Patterns of migration indicate that this was an economy and society in flux. Now, given these changes and given the anxieties of white workers, it is interesting to find whites in general trying to find a source of privilege for themselves in this changing economy. And one way is to focus on skin color and to say no matter how poor we are, no matter how tenuous our position in society today, no matter how much we're struggling to retain a foothold in this economy, at least we are not darker skinned, at least we do not have ancestors, forefathers, or foremothers who were enslaved. In other words, the sheer presence of African Americans helped to give white workers what we might call a negative reference group. These white workers said to themselves, we are not women, we are not children, we are not slaves, or the grandchildren of slaves. And in that way, identified themselves, gave themselves, as I said, a rather privileged identity in the midst of a transforming economy. A similar process, I think, took place in the late 19th century, where, as I mentioned, machines were helping to define the working class. And certainly, if African Americans as a group were barred from machine labor, then again, white workers could take some pride, no matter how modest their circumstances, take some pride in their white skin and the relative privileges that their skin afforded them.
Mm-hmm. Now, in discussing this kind of racial rationalization, you turned a phrase in your introduction that really struck me when you said that in terms of racial ideologies, that, quote, rhetoric more often than not follows function, unquote. Would you explain that phrase and give us an example?
Yes, again, I was referring to the antebellum period in the North where there were tremendous efforts to subordinate black people through legal means, restrictions placed on their ability to migrate and find new jobs. In most states, blacks were barred from voting, serving on juries, sending their children to school. And that subordination obviously gave white workers advantages in the labor force, in the political realm as well. And I think whites were referring to the subordinate position of blacks, a position already accomplished through law, they were referring to the contempt that they held for blacks for being so vulnerable and so subject to that kind of subordination. There's obviously a perverse process at work here where whites do their best to prevent black people from having much in the way of rights or privileges and then turn that vulnerability into a justification for leaving blacks out of the political realm. So in that sense, I meant that the subordination comes first, that it is a way of preserving white privilege, and yet that subordination becomes a rationalization for prejudice. One abolitionist during this period said, we dislike black people because we are unjust to them. And by that he meant that whites took the legal inequality, the legal inferiority of black people as a justification for continuing to suppress them.
Mm-hmm. And along similar lines, I mean, in terms of racism and this kind of perversity, you explained how white people held two mutually exclusive stereotypes of blacks. That is, one, as rapacious job seekers, your term, and in quote, lazy people unwilling to work, unquote. How can these exclusive irrational prejudices exist at the same time?
Well, what is striking, I think, too, is not only how they occurred in the past, but also how they persist in the present. I found during the period before the Civil War, for example, black people were perceived as very poor, and indeed many of them were very poor. They had been released from bondage with very little in the way of material resources and found it difficult in such a racist society to make a living for themselves. And the charge was that they would become a burden to taxpayers. They would fill the almshouses, and it would be difficult to support black people, black children, and so forth. So there was that stereotype that arose from the very difficult struggles that blacks faced after emancipation. On the other hand, black people and black communities did rise to the occasion and struggle to send their children to school, to find the very best jobs possible, and in their quest for employment seemed to become threatening to whites, who then turned that struggle for jobs into a threat to their own well-being. So it was in this time and place that black people were perceived as yes, very poor, a drain on the public coffers on the one hand, but also as threatening to white livelihoods on the other. And, you know, we think about these stereotypes, and it's hard to reconcile them, but they did coexist in the minds of many whites during this period.
Mm-hmm. Now, considering these kinds of conditions, you then concluded that there's only been minimal intergenerational upward mobility for blacks. Why is this?
Well, certainly that's a generalization, but by that I meant once black people were kept out of modern jobs in the late 19th century, well into the 20th century, that really hindered their ability to care for themselves and their families. And by the time black people in general got a foothold in the industrial economy, which was not really until World War II, we see major changes occurring in the economy. Automation, the use of more sophisticated kinds of machinery and technology, firms begin to streamline, consolidate their operations. This is true, for instance, for the auto industry. Blacks managed to get good jobs in the auto industry for the first time during World War II. And yet by the early 50s, many of those jobs were rendered obsolete by new forms of machinery. And it is, I think, a bitter irony in terms of American history that just at the point where the federal government began to dismantle the Jim Crow legal machinery in the mid-60s, for instance, with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title VII, which for the first time barred racial discrimination in employment, that the global economy also began to work on the domestic economy. And as a result, the whole structure of the labor force changed as a result. That meant that, again, blacks did not have the advantages of whites, the generational advantages that might have allowed them to accumulate a stake and pass that along to their children in the process.
Mm-hmm. So in a brief conclusion then, you also argued that there have only been superficial results from affirmative action. In a half minute or so, why?
I think the problems here, again, relate to the jobs that people are finding today. And even middle class African Americans, I think, are very vulnerable to changes in the economy, to downsizing, to consolidation of operations in corporations, for instance. And those African Americans, like Americans in general, without much in the way of formal education, will find themselves stuck in the service sector, which does not really, those jobs don't really provide a living wage. So it's, I think there is one final issue here, and that is that African American families have not been able to gather the resources to pass on to their children the way the white middle class has, in terms of property values, savings accounts. These are things that are bequeathed to subsequent generations. And even middle class African American families, I think, are just barely able to maintain that status, and they have very little in the way of large bequests to leave to their children.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Jacqueline Jones of Brandeis University and the author of American Work, published by Norton.
For most of us, Labor Day marks the end of summer. For some, these last long, lovely, lazy days, often spent vacationing with our families, give us one last moment to reflect on all our summers past and on our personal family histories. Here to reflect on his family's history is Brent Spencer. Spencer is the director of creative writing at Creighton University. His fiction has appeared in Atlantic Monthly, the American Literary Review, and GQ, and he's the author of the novel The Lost Son and a collection of short stories, Are We Not Men?
I've been thinking about history here at the tag end of summer, not history with a capital H, not history of institutions and great men whose records fill archives everywhere, but personal history, the history of family and friends. Small age history. I'm looking at old photographs. My mother's high school graduation picture shows her standing beside a small frame house between two shoulder-high forsythia bushes. She's wearing a homemade dress and a mortarboard. There's a look of determination on her taut face. She had the same look at 4 years old. In this picture, she's standing next to the same house, its raw siding curling away from the studs, the forsythia just a splash of blossom in a window box. This dress, too, is homemade, from a flower sack, but her mother has sewn three perfectly useless buttons near the left shoulder, a touch of style. Everything in these pictures, the cracked siding, the flower sack dress with its three jaunty buttons, even the look of determination, all these things are pieces of history. In the next picture, from 1952, she's married. You can tell. All the earlier pictures show her standing stiffly before the camera, the posture meant to please a parent. In this one, she's lounging in an Adirondack chair. She's wearing an untucked plaid blouse and blue jeans rolled up to look like pedal pushers. One knee is raised, a loafered foot resting on the seat of the chair. Her gaze is direct, her hair perned, her smile scandalous. It's a starlet's pose, a pose meant to please a husband. Though the picture was taken next to the same Indiana farmhouse, it's a completely different world, a Riviera of the mind. My grandmother put that Adirondack chair together from a kit. She was like that. When the engine on her Model A pickup went out, she ordered a new one, bought a manual, and installed it herself. Here's a picture of the proud family showing off its wheels. My aunt, at three, is actually climbing the front bumper. But now I realize it isn't the truck they're showing off, but what's inside, the working engine. It's almost as though my aunt, realizing the potential misunderstanding, wants to flip open the wings of the hood to show off my grandmother's handiwork. Summer's ending, and so is the millennium. Soon we'll be bombarded with lists of the era's most important and influential people. These photographs remind me that not all historically important figures wear suits and ties or lead armies, or head up countries and corporations. Some of them build Adirondack chairs and teach themselves to install truck engines. Some of them are our grandparents, our parents, our brothers and sisters, our neighbors, our friends, ourselves. Remember that in the stream of history, everybody matters.
You've been listening to Brent Spencer, author of the novel The Lost Son and the collection of short stories, Are We Not Men? This is Talking History. Summer certainly is a charming time of the year, but fall has a certain magic of its own, and for a fortunate few, some off-season travel beckons with the benefits of lower rates and smaller crowds. If you're among the fortunate few and looking for a magical historic site to visit, we may have just the place. And here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The medieval fortresses of Holland have a special charm and magic. The Neder Castle, only 10 miles from Amsterdam, was built in 1280 for a count who was murdered there 16 years later. The largest castle in the Netherlands is the De Haar Castle, surrounded by a moat and boasts a lavish interior of Louis XIV and XVI furnishings, tapestries, and Far Eastern art. The castles in the Netherlands, complete with dormers, rotund towers, moats, and bridges, first began appearing in the 12th century, and at one time there were more than 3,000 castles in that small country. However, the passage of time, wars, and theft took their toll, and now there are only about 100 still remaining, ranging from authentic medieval structures to contemporary restorations with original ground plans.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, North Side Story, a documentary on one of the nation's most unique historical urban areas, will air on PBS on September 20th. The 90-minute program takes a look at the people and places of Pittsburgh's North Side, home to landmarks like the headquarters of the Heinz Company and the Funky Warhol Museum, and reputed to have once had more millionaires per square mile than any other place in America. Check your local listings for showtimes. And This Land Is Your Land, an exhibit on the life and legacy of Woody Guthrie, has opened in Los Angeles, California, at the Gene Autry Museum of Western Heritage. Guthrie, perhaps the most famous folk singer in American history, began as a Dust Bowl refugee during the 1930s and the Great Depression, but his empathy for the common man infused his music with purpose and sparked a lifelong dedication to social activism. This exhibit, which closes on September 26, tells Guthrie's story. For more information, contact the Autry Museum in Los Angeles. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week for a very interesting look at the history of fairy tales. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions by email to talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Well, Grandpa wore his suits in nearly every day. No particular reason, he just dressed that way. Brown necktie and a matching vest, both his wingtip shoes. He built a closet on our back porch and put a penny in a burned out pew. Grandpa was a carpenter, he built houses, stores, and banks. James Monk had a cigarette.